from today. So this is an actual model of what happens in a TSO-based memory model. So there you see I've changed the example program into one which has a store as its first operation. So one goes into A or one goes into B. And then those values are read in the pairwise other thread. So like this, for example. And that is a typical situation which is not depending on the actual order in which the stores have been occurring in the program order, but instead they are depending on the communication of updates between particular threads. And well, that plays out the following way. So you see that there's everything is shared in the beginning. So we have shared state 0 for each of these things. The store buffer is, for our purposes, just empty so far. And what then happens whenever one of the updates is carried out, we enter the update into the store buffer as well as over here, and simply continue our execution as if the store would have been already carried out. And this would result in a read of, in this case, variable B, in this case, variable A, which would, well, as reads don't check the store buffer directly. They would instead go down to the cache line, at least if the store buffer doesn't intervene with the information about that particular cell, and there is no information about that. So it would obtain the old value 0, and this would be what ever ends up in this printf over here. And for this one over here, we also have no other information than just 0, so this is transported over here. So we get prints of the old values in that sense, and only later on, at some point, when the cache controller at some point has free time where it can schedule the actual updates, then it will perform the updates, and it will realize, for example, that in this case over here, it needs to communicate with B. It sees that B is in shared state, so what it does is it issues it says read. I think it's missing the, or it's the, not the appropriate thing. It should be an actual invalidate, since we have a shared memory line over here. So this goes over here and will be, is it actually? This B goes over here, yeah, and it does not answer with a write back, since this is just in shared, but it will answer with a acknowledgement. So this one gets invalidated. It's invalid now, and this one is now first exclusive and then in the end modified and one, and then the store buffer is empty for this one. And in the same fashion, the other store buffer is emptied, so it issues an invalidate, which will then lead to invalid over here and modified one over there. So that is the usual way that this plays out, with, again, not completely correct things over here. So, this is how the TSO or a TSO example would turn out to be. So what is the impact of something like TSO? Well, this is exactly the memory model that is behind the the usual desktop and or server CPUs. So this is quite common in the wild. And this is quite handy since these FIFO store buffers are, well, quite strong model and in that sense are quite close to what you would expect from a working system, in the sense that if you have the intention that this is if you get the impression that this could be somehow consistent, then it actually will very probably be. The only major obstacle to sequential consistency is this one property that we have sorted out in the formal definition, particularly that you can't rely on a store that is program ordered before a load to actually keep that order in the end, in the memory ordering also. So the store might be somehow delayed and carried out after the load and program order has been carried out. So that is something that would work against sequential consistency. But in order to cope with that, the x86 architecture provides the memory fence instruction. So there's this mFence thing that you might have encountered somewhere. And this is an instruction that would order other memory instructions. So with that, if you place that in between two operations, operation prime, then they would appear in the same order in the actual memory ordering. So this is there to repair the locations where it actually would harm the correctness of your program. But you have to take care of this ordering yourself if you actually need that. So, if you then say, well, isn't that nice with such a thing? I can make my programs sequentially consistent, so I should probably add them at every spot that I can imagine where a store is followed by a load. Well, you can, of course, do that, and you will arrive at a sequentially consistent CPU, but in those cases you will probably lose every nuance of performance gain that has been implemented by these store buffers in the beginning. So you will end up with a program as slow or even slower as the raw program on a actual sequential consistent machine. So you should probably be careful when placing fences, so that you will, of course, place them in the spots where they are actually necessary, but not be overly generous with placing mFences everywhere. But of course, well, in most cases you won't do any harm by just placing one, apart from performance issues. So the other model that is more weak than before is called the PSO model, which is the partial store order. And this loses a very kind of prominent property from the TSO model. Particularly what it loses is the rule that has been there for the last specification. And what is new here in particular is this sFence thing over here. So where the total store order had specified that stores appearing in program order would always appear in memory order, this is not the case anymore for the partial store order. And that's, of course, reflected in the name. It's not total store order anymore, but partial store order. In order to establish an ordering between stores, now you have to explicitly order them in by means of a fencing instruction like this sFence over here. The only real store ordering that you still get is the one where you actually where you address the same memory location. So for those, of course, still the store order is transported to the memory order. Apart from that, the rest is pretty similar to what we have seen before. And all in all, what we get from that is that now also stores are not guaranteed to be in order anymore. In terms of kind of abstract machine model, what does that mean? Well, going back to our abstract machine model, this would mean that these things that are called store buffer actually don't act as a buffer in the sense that we have had them in our basic data structure courses anymore. So the buffer is not a FIFO data structure anymore. I found that highly disorientating, but I don't know how you feel about that. So there's the concept of the unordered store buffer, which is kind of the abstract machine basis for the PSO model. So you can imagine some kind of random scratch pad being between the CPU and the actual cache that is randomly selected for stores that are applied to the actual cache line. So that is the model that is behind PSO, and with that in mind, you can imagine that it's the important football games right now. As long as there are no actual bets on there, I think we can probably delay that for afterwards. So with that in mind, you can probably guess that we lose the ordering between subsequent stores now, since there's no actual FIFO treatment of the buffer anymore. So yeah, that is what is behind the PSO model, and well, this leads to the kind of behavior that you have seen last time in the lecture, where I have sketched that, well, there's this this behavior of the system where one update goes into the store buffer while the other update maybe hits the store buffer for a short moment, but then immediately is carried out before the first one is even touched. So that is kind of what has happened in this example last time, and I was already struggling with that when I went out of the lecture hall. Yeah. Well, it's not really non-deterministic in terms of what the hardware knows, but for our purposes, we can't really discern how it will play out. So there are probably some kind of heuristics or some kind of internal implementation-dependent reordering. Maybe if there is a cache line already present, then those things are carried out right at that particular moment, because it's so cheap to do that. So yeah, that might be also the motivation behind why you drop this FIFO property, because some of the updates can be applied to the cache lines quite easily when the cache line is already loaded, and others might stall you quite a lot of time when you still have to fetch the cache line from the memory or something. So that might be the reason why you would like to drop this FIFO requirement on the buffer. Yeah. So all in all, that's kind of inconvenient for our intuition. So we would rather like this assertion not to be violated in some sense, but that's not coming for free. So the only thing to prevent that is by using write barriers. So these make sure that stores that occur in one CPU in a particular order can be perceived by other CPUs also in that order, and that this perception can be guaranteed. So, yeah. As an example, you can see how this works over here in this thing. So, we have now added this write barrier instruction called sfence over here. This works as follows. So we have S0, E0, invalid, and S0, and the store buffer is empty in the beginning. What happens then is that the update for A is entered into the store buffer in the beginning. Then there's the sfence, and what the sfence does is it marks all the updates that it finds in the store buffer. So what I do is I put a line over there to do the actual markup, and then terminates. And later on, at some point, the logic of the CPU might decide that it's time to actually apply a particular store. So what's happening here is that this is tried to be carried out, and notices that it has the cache line in shared mode. So what? Oh well. It tries to invalidate this cache line, which will be acknowledged over here with invalid state now. This will go into modified state. And cleaning the store buffer. And you see that there's a lot of lines going in chaos over here. It might seem so, but that's for a particular reason, since this thing over here is also a store. It's an update to the address of B, and the semantics of the write barrier is that all other writes or stores that meant to happen now stall until the store buffer is free of any of those marked items, and only then the execution can continue. So well, in principle what happens is that maybe let me correct that. So first of all, of course, this B1 is also entered in the store buffer, while the A1 is still in there. The A1 goes away as soon as the invalidate is coming back. So after this, there's not enough space here, but in principle, after this event comes back, the A1 is removed from the thing, so there's only B1 left in there, which is not marked. So then, actually, when there's no marked entries in the store buffer anymore, the execution of this new store can continue. And this B1 is still in the queue, and at some point the system might decide to carry out the actual update of B1, which is done over here by going from E to M and clearing the buffer. So that is what happens in there. So there's a few updates to what has been presented over here as the according lines, but yeah, so that is the idea. So sfence marks all the current items in the store buffer. As soon as another new store arrives at the scene, its store goes into a store buffer, but the store now has to wait until every other store has been carried out, and only then execution can continue, and the store buffer remains with the new update over here. And yeah, so that's what happens here, and the rest of the system works as you would think it works. So it, this needs to read the line. So what it does, it will go to shared one. Yeah, so this is not fulfilled anymore. The while loop is exited, and we go over to the next assertion. And here we have invalid state, so we have to read. We go over to shared one, and we'll communicate that back. And we see that now value if, of A is actually 1, as we would have expected. So that is how it actually internally works. Yes, please. The waiting for what? No, that's not necessarily the case, since the store buffer is in the TSO model FIFO buffer. You can just commit your store directly into the buffer, and the FIFO nature of the data structure guarantees that it will arrive in the same order as it has been issued in the original program, also to the cache line, and thus in the end also to the memory. So the only thing that is somehow not in order is reads, because they don't go into any buffer, they are always carried out immediately, and a write can remain in the store buffer for some time, even though in between there might be reads that are already carried out, and that is the way how writes can somehow overtake reads, but still remain in their own respective order. Yes. On the x86 system, this mFence is a general fence for every memory action there is. So this is a generic memory fence. This orders, loads, and stores. sFence, well, that is kind of a name that I have chosen for that. I think it would be some kind of a read barrier or something like RB in the context of Linux kernel programming, for example. So this sFence is kind of deprecated instruction that still flies around there in the internet for all the x86 documentations when, well, the memory model for x86 has changed a little bit over time, and there had been times when there were actual separate sFences and lFences out there. So, yeah, that's why there's still this sFence around. But this is supposed to be a so-called store fence, or also write barrier. So this only applies to for sorting writes or stores. So this is particularly used to only give an ordering to store buffers, and it doesn't affect the ordering of reads, as the mFence does. Is that satisfying for you? That's, well, you can imagine there being also a load fence. We'll come to that a little bit later on. lFence, and the mFence is just lFence and sFence combined in that sense. So, yeah. There's really not too much complication about that. It's just that in the setting of TSO, it doesn't make sense to have an sFence, because the stores are sorted anyway. So, doesn't make sense to have one of those. Okay. This we had already, so that's it. Then we can continue by further weakening our model with out-of-order reads. So again, keep in mind, this might not be what the actual hardware does. This is to describe the semantics of how local memory accesses behave in comparison to memory accesses as observed by other CPUs. So this is an abstract machine. The concrete machine might do something completely different, but this still serves for defining what possible executions might look like and which of them are actually admissible for a particular memory system. So it's an abstract model. So the kind of motivation that is behind this particular abstract machine model is that if you have a computation that involves a lot of different memory cells and locations, you might access a lot of different cache lines, and such a computation can fill up the store buffer of your CPU pretty quickly, since you continue and continue and continue after each of the stores, and the store buffer might be quite slow in applying its changes to the cache line due to the cache having to wait for the main memory, for example, to fetch certain lines. So store buffers might fill up quicker than you would wish, and as soon as you run out of space in your store buffers, your the next store that arrives will have to wait for a new slot in the store buffer to be opened, and this means that it's again waiting for the invalidation acknowledgement to actually happen. Thus, is again depending on the workload on other CPUs, whether there is a free capacity to actually answer your invalidation request. And the idea behind this particular model is now to introduce an invalidate queue at the CPU that is asked for invalidation of its cache line. So the idea is that CPU A, when it needs to store something to a cache line, it will at some point, when a store is carried out from the store buffer, will issue an invalidation request, and this invalidation request will go straight from its cache into the invalidation queue and will be answered right away with invalidation acknowledged. And we'll wait there for the busy cache of CPU B to be ready for new action, and only a little bit later on then in the end carry out the invalidation of the cache line. So this buffers the invalidation messages at the targeted CPU. Okay, so this seems a little bit dangerous, of course, when you imagine that the other CPU might at some point also decide that it wants to write to that particular cache line. But the idea is that the system, as soon as your store cannot be locally done, in the sense that the cache line is not exclusive to you, and there is a invalidate message waiting in the invalidate queue, that your invalidation message is not carried out by the system. Instead, your cache line gets evicted and you will have to re-request this cache line before your invalidation request goes out. So that should take care of racing particular updates, and well, take care of that that parts of the updates won't be lost. So that is kind of the way that this is supposed to actually work in this abstract model. Again, there is a formal model for relaxed memory ordering out there, and this is now a little bit more different than the models before. So here the only thing that we get for granted without doing anything explicit like fencing the memory is that stores to the same address in a program can be found in this same order in the memory ordering. So only if you access the same particular address A in two stores in your local program order, then you will find these events also in the memory order. Then there's also another thing that we get without even having to do anything, and that is a dependency between load and any other operation OP that in that case. And this is this ordering in the memory order is happening if the load and this operation op is related in dependence ordering. So yet another ordering. This is something made up in the specification for the relaxed memory ordering, also taken from the Spark system, because those are the only ones who actually bother with setting up real formal specifications of their models. So in comparison, what can you find out there for memory specifications from other manufacturers? Well, collections of examples of what they do in which cases. And yeah, these lead to quite a lot of discussions in the community and unclarity about what actually happens. And yeah, it's quite gruesome to have to rely on that kind of documentation to do something reliable in terms of memory access. But yeah, so every opportunity where you can find something like this, you're actually really glad, although this seems like a lot of formalism. Anyway, what is this dependence relation about? Well, the thing where well, at least for that particular application case, the part that is relevant is, well, there is one condition where things are dependence ordered. This is whenever operation double prime and the original operation without any primes are having well, they are, if they are data flow dependent in the sense that the operation double prime somehow does an output into a particular register that is read by the operation without any prime. So if the target register of the operation is the same as the source register register for the other operation, then they are in dependence order. So that is one cause for this whole thing. So if you load something into register and then, for example, use it for writing it into that the content of that register in some other location, then those things are in dependence order and they have to be in memory ordering also. So that is one of the things that is important. The other one is the control flow dependency. So these are the cases where the first operation is is feeding the condition of a conditional branch, with data. So you maybe load the content of some memory address into memory and use that for a conditional branch. Then all the stores that are in any of the branch targets of that particular conditional branch are said to be dependence ordered with respect to the original operation. So this is just formalization that the first operation has a data flow influence on a conditional branch that is able to branch to the store that we're talking about. So this is kind of the other major cause for these dependence ordering. So if that is something that happens, this also needs to be reflected in the memory order. And the other thing, this is talking about same addresses, so this is kind of pretty simple. So if you store to a particular address and then at some point later load from that address, well, this is also contributing to dependence ordering and needs to be reflected in the memory order, although, well, since here explicitly loads are required on the left-hand side of the precedence of the dependence order, well, the SODA doesn't apply for that particular condition. So I'm not sure whether this was overseen in the formal specification or whether there is another use for dependence ordering that is not particularly for specifying the relaxed memory ordering. I don't actually frankly know. I've just put it on there to give you an idea of what the formalisms are all about. So this is the relaxed memory ordering. So there's not much left of any ordering of operations at all, particularly when there are common addresses involved and there are some dependencies in terms of data flow involved between particular particular instructions. Then there is a dependency that carries over carries on into the memory order. And the motivation for that is probably not so much introducing something like this invalidated buffer, but instead being able to actually perform speculation in your machine and being able to actually make use of the loads that you have issued at an earlier point later on in your program. And that is somehow a thing that you can maybe see when you look at these conditional branch things, because these are the deciding factors in speculation also. So that is maybe the connection to that. So anyway, what happens in the abstract machine model is something that we can model with our happened before diagrams. And here we have a system where there is a store buffer, and the store buffer is relevant for the parts where there's actually stores happening. So that's why I only painted it in the first part of the diagram, and you see, well, there's the parts of the invalidations are carried out so that the next one can actually terminate. And while they are carried out, you see that the invalidation only reaches the invalidate queue. So here the invalidation for I think A it is actually acknowledged by CPU B, although B happily lives on with shared 0 being the state for the cache line for A and invalid for the cache line of B, but that doesn't matter too much. And yeah, of course, when a control reaches the evaluation of condition of the condition for the while loop, this is an invalid cache line, so you can't read from that. You need to query the other process, and well, the update can be directly queried from there, which is then shared. What is it? Shared one, which is communicated over here, so that the next instruction is reachable. Now, this one is unaware of the content of the invalidate buffer. A load in this case can be answered directly from the cache line, since this is just a valid thing, shared zero here. So this is answered with zero, which will then violate the assertion, because turns out that there has been an invalidation request lurking in the background, which is, well, in the end then carried out. So there was this A over here, which could be applied to the cache line then, and this has gone invalid from there on. So this is what happens if your model is allowing invalidate queues, and you don't, you're not careful with countermeasures, because in the same way as store buffers can be dealt with, there's also ways of dealing with invalidate buffers. So they're invalidate queues. So to counteract that, you read an out of date value. In cases where you communicate with other processes, you kind of expect that at some point there will be a write update on the memory location that you're interested in. So what you usually do in these cases is that you insert an explicit read barrier instruction before the read access. And in that particular model, what it is supposed to do is it reads... triggers that the next load is only carried out when all the currently available invalidation messages in the invalidate queue have been processed. It does so with the same technique as before. It uses marks for everything that is at that moment found in the invalidate queue, and as soon as it has removed everything that was marked, then the next read is again able to be processed and will be carried out on the new state of the cache, which will then be hopefully up to date, or at least up to date of the read barrier. So yeah, that is how this is supposed to work. So what you're essentially going to do is you will match each of the write barriers in the other process with a read barrier in your local process. So that is usually the approach to that. And that way, what we will do is we will add what we call what we call a load fence or a read barrier in here, and this is the thing that triggers that the invalidate queue is processed, and in the end the invalidation will be carried out to that cache line, so that for that thing over here we will have another communication with the other process. So yeah, that is the invalidate queues. And yeah, uh, you mean that if we, what is the S fence is your thing? So if you remove the S fence, you mean? Well, the thing is that if you remove the S fence, there's no guarantee that the update on A is actually carried out on the cache line. And the invalidation will never arrive at the invalidate queue, and thus we will happily continue with the wrong value in the cache line. So in that sense, when there's store buffers, and in this case non-FIFO store buffers involved, then you will need the S fence, and if there is also an invalidate queue, we will even more need an L fence on the other side. So both of them are necessary for in that setting to actually work. Good. So, oh, sorry. Yeah. That depends on the machine you're working on. Because, well, if you work on the x86 is not an architecture that is relaxed for most parts. And thus... The what? MFence is present, yes. And it is inserted at the places where it's actually where it makes sense, then. But we will come to the point where we talk about where things might be automatically inserted or not. So usually you have to take care of setting fences manually. So that's what we will tackle now, particularly in an example on relaxed memory ordering, relaxed memory ordered systems, and the algorithms that are there for showing what is happening on these machines are usually very low level algorithms that try to establish some kind of higher level functionality. In our case, we look at the so-called Decker algorithm. I don't know, does anyone know the Decker algorithm yet? Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. Yeah, it's a simplistic algorithm that is there for synchronizing two processes, and exactly two processes, and is working with particular preconditions. So this is how it usually works. You have a few management variables which you need, these flags and the turn thing. These flag arrays or the flag array is serving as a means of mutual exclusion. So you set the flag that you are interested in entering the critical section, and in case that is it is actually your turn also, so the turn reflects your ID, then you are supposed to enter the critical section. If any of those are not pointing to you, then you usually have to wait for either of them to be free. So how it's actually done is then, well, what you do is you flag up as process null, process zero, you flag the slot for zero as, well, I'm being interested in entering the critical section. Then what you do is you check whether your peer is also interested in entering the critical section by checking the flag slot for process 1. And then it all is depending on whether it's your turn or your peer's turn. So if it's your turn, then this condition will not hold. So you keep retrying this while loop until your peer has come to his the turn is his turn, so he needs to at some point release his interest in in entering the critical section, and as soon as he does that, your your flag will then be the other flag will be false, so you drop out of the while loop and then enter the critical section, where you in the end will make sure that at some point it's the other process's turn, and then flag that you are now leaving the critical section. Well, of course, this needs another another process that competes for the critical section, and this one is accessing the variables in exactly the other way around. So this one flags up its interest in slot 1 and has to check the slot 0 for another interest, and he interprets the turn value the other way around as process 0, so it's kind of a mirrored version of P0. So this is something that relies heavily on common variables and access to common variables, and also, well, since it's two processes, they access these variables in concurrent fashion. So they are competing for access to these variables, and they do a mixture of reading and writing on these things. So this already smells a lot like trouble if you have systems that have problems with dealing with reading and writing accesses to common variables. So the kind of precondition, there's again the idea behind the Decker algorithm. So, yeah, these are the steps that this algorithm does. So the key precondition for the whole thing to work is that you're actually working on a sequentially consistent system. So in these systems, reading and writing common variables is not a big deal, and you can rely on those things to be somehow consistent. However, since these systems are kind of hard to obtain nowadays, you will probably have to rely on other measures of running this thing if you're interested in how this actually works. And for exercise purposes, we have here a very nasty memory ordering, or well, nasty with respect to consistency, heavenly with respect to possibilities for hardware optimizations. So relaxed memory ordering is our base consistency model over here. And in order to make the algorithm work on these kind of systems, what you need to do there is you need to make sure that the reads and writes are properly fenced. in some way. So what you do is you manually insert memory barriers between the variables that are common to both threads. So these are then usually the variables for flag and turn. So, well, you already see how this turns out to be in the end. So there's the thing that as soon as you want to observe a certain sequence of stores, you will have to introduce the write barriers. So you will add S fences. Usually, whenever you've done a store operation that you that goes to variable that is referred to on the other side of the algorithm, and then we said you usually match up each of the writes or stores to a variable that is seen on the other side with appropriate read barriers, and that is what the L fence is all about. So you insert an L fence each time that a load is carried out. So you add the L fences over here, and that's probably all the common places. So this is what you would have to adapt your algorithm in order to actually work. And well, here's also mentioned that on some systems there's this M-fence thing, which is considered to be a combined L-fence and S-fence, and you can replace the two fence instructions that are one after each other to one of these M-fence things, but I don't know whether you actually really gain anything from doing that. So that is measurements that you usually have to do in order to make sure that these low-level programs actually really work. And to give you an idea that these relaxed memory models are not only things that are of kind of academic use and for ancient systems only, since, well, I don't know how many Spark V8 installations you have encountered in your life so far. I'm guessing rather not so many. But it turns out that these relaxed memory models are not a thing that is exclusive to that particular architecture. I just took the formal definition of the memory model from there. I think the Alpha architecture was even earlier than the Spark architecture, but there's also kind of more practically relevant systems out there that have relaxed memory models. Particularly, you might put your hand in your pocket and get out your mobile phone, and there you have a system with relaxed memory model. So, yeah, that's actually relevant architecture right now, and for well, ARM also has different architectures depending on what actual processor model you have installed in your system, but a lot of them have relaxed memory model features, and for those if you program a little bit lower than just your ordinary Objective-C or Java model, then you will at some point hit the actual architecture level of memory consistency, and there you have to take care not to run into any race induced problems. So that's relaxed memory models. So these are very, very low-level synchronization primitives. You might argue, when do I actually really need them? So what they're best suited for is algorithms that where you use processes to implement particular automata, and you you want these automata to collaborate with each other by exchanging information in terms of common variables, and if changes occur in these variables, other processes can see it and do transitions in their automata. So that is usually a way how very low-level protocols can be implemented quite easily, and that's the way that, for example, operating systems implement their higher-level synchronization features. They usually keep to particular usage protocols of their underlying automata, and use that to give you a more high-level and comfortable view on synchronization facilities. So that's what they are usually used for. So you would probably not use these synchronization primitives in order to do some complicated network algorithm, or maybe some other complicated sorting algorithm or something. So most of the cases it gets complicated quite fast, and you will end up placing a lot of fences into your algorithm which are maybe not so necessary, and you would have quite often come to a better solution by just using the high-level interfaces of the operating system provided things like locks, and I've come up with maybe solutions that are as quick as the ones that you have achieved with your low-level synchronization primitives. So that much about these things, but well, we can't say where you will end up when you finish your studies here. Maybe you are in a position where you will implement operating system specific algorithms, tasks, and facilities, and in those cases you might be interested in pursuing these kinds of things. There's also the aspects of compilers and their role in terms of reordering of operations, and for example, you might imagine an algorithm like this one over here, where you initialize a variable with zero and then loop 100 times and set x to 1 and then print that particular thing. That might be, or might look like a dumb algorithm at the first point, and the compiler probably also agrees, and it will probably do something to your algorithm. I don't know. Any idea what a compiler might do to that? Yeah? So that's what a compiler would usually do. So there's a phase in the compiler which does program optimizations, and there's certain techniques of program optimizations out there that actually move around stores that happen in your program. So there's the concept of analysis for loop invariant code. So the compiler checks whether at any possibility that that particular location is reached in any execution, there is, no matter what precondition there is, always this thing happens, then this might be moved to another place. So if it's a loop invariant particularly, it can be moved outside of the loop, so this would transport this x is assigned to 1 outside of the loop, and then later on there will be at some point a phase which will deal with dead stores, so stores that store values into places where the value is already in. So this is dead store analysis, and dead stores are usually candidates for elimination, so this X is assigned 1 will in the end get eliminated. Well, this looks fine until you realize that you're in a parallel system and have another thread that at some point tries to communicate with your thread and tries to set the value of x to 0. And, well, there's a considerable different behavior of the code on the left-hand side and the code on the right-hand side. So at one point you will maybe at one point see that there is a 0 involved in printing out, but it will be overwritten the next time that the printf is happening. On the other side, well, the 0 will stay in that variable forever and will never be overwritten anymore. So this is actually a behavior-changing thing, and that is something that program optimizations should in principle never be about. So they should be semantics preserving in that sense. So that is something that is highly undesirable, and this is also related to this concept of out-of-order execution, but just not an out-of-order execution that comes from actual hardware interference, but rather out-of-order execution that is due to the compiler messing with the code that you've provided it. So, in that context, you can imagine that it's also important to discuss consistency guarantees that the compiler system gives to you, and memory models being specified on language level are actually important. So, what does actual C compilers do in that respect? Well, there the concept of fencer have a kind of a further use than just blocking hardware-based reordering of executions. Instead, for example, if you are eager to keep the semantics of your program intact, what you can do is you can place such a write barrier, or an S-fence in our wording, into your program, which will keep stores from being reordered in front of the S-fence. So that is something that should not be able to be done anymore when the S-fence is there, and the compiler usually keeps to that and tries to preserve the assignment to one at that particular point. Doing that on an x86 is probably quite funny, since S-fence has no actual semantics on the x86 architecture, so there is no use for write barriers in terms of hardware involved, but this is merely a kind of means of communicating to the compiler that you wish it not to interfere with the ordering that you have put onto your stores in there. So that's that. There's also other means of telling the compiler to not bugger you with your memory ordering. Don't know whether you have any idea how to do that. Exactly. So that is the other thing that you can do. You can declare the variable that you don't want to be moved around in terms of stores or loads by specifying them as volatile, and in those cases the compiler would also keep your store in place and never move it around, so it would refrain from applying those out of order optimizations on your variable. So that is the thing that, or the things that you can do in order to keep your out-of-order executions to those variables where they can be safely applied. Does anyone know what the Java approach to that is? So what Java does is it also interprets the volatile keyword particularly, but not in the same way as the C compiler does. What it does is it generates the barriers that are relevant for your particular machine model, such that those variables won't be reordered. So if you use the volatile specifier for Java keywords, then you get your execution preserved at the particular ordering where you specify them in your program. So that's the way that a Java compiler does that. So, all in all, we get from this particular lesson that, well, there's several levels of consistency that might be of interest to you. There's a rather theoretical strict consistency that is kind of an idealistic view on how algorithms should work, that comes from a point of view of linear execution of programs without any concurrency. Then, since there's this doesn't carry over too much or too well into the world of concurrent execution, we need some different notion of whenever we consider a system as being somewhat consistent. And for that, we have introduced this notion of happened before relations, and made use of that to define what we consider to be intuitively consistent, which was the sequential consistency. And I had a look at systems that would give us that. For example, well, of course, the cacheless systems, then the systems with caches that would apply the MESI cache protocol. Then we realized, well, although caches are already speeding up our program execution a lot, we might want to benefit more from the hardware by allowing alterations in the ordering of the memory accesses that we send to the system. This leads to kind of a hierarchy in models that start up very strongly with the sequentially consistent models, down to the TSO models with FIFO store buffers, going to this intermediate step of partial store order with store buffers that don't have any notion of being an actual buffer. Then there's this very weak memory model, the so-called relaxed memory ordering, where in the abstract model we have the invalidate queues. In practical systems, there's probably different approaches to that with speculation and some, well, funky interoperation of caches on a very low level. And we've talked about the means of re-establishing sequential consistency at those locations where they actually matter, particularly the variables that are used for communication between different processes without further high-level means like locks or monitors or anything like that. So that would be the memory barriers, and we have looked at an example algorithm that tries to establish higher-level control mechanisms like mutual exclusion by working on this very low level, which would be this Decker's algorithm. So that's kind of what we have seen in that particular lecture. So what's out there? Yep. It can, but it doesn't need to. So it's a matter of what guarantees you give and what the implementation actually does. So you can you can always overfulfill your duties. That's that's not the problem of the of the user. Then, well, you might kind of throw away some potential for obtaining better performance by not having to be restricted by those stronger consistency needs. So, but you could do. Sorry? So relaxed things can, well, can use any kind of store buffer they want. So so like unordered ones could be fine. Yeah. So there's no guarantee on the order of stores anymore in the definition of relaxed memory ordering, so I don't care. Good. Yeah, so there's kind of an outlook in what else is there in cache coherency that might be of interest. So there's several ideas of speeding up inter-CPU communication by altering the actual MESI protocol into, well, versions where you don't have so many one-to-all communication cases. So there's the idea of, for example, establishing a new state on for cache lines with where you establish that one particular cache considers itself to be the authority in terms of answering to read requests. So usually what you get when you issue a read request is that everyone is kind of in a hurry to answer that read request and bombards the bus with answers, and for there's potential in well in this system to be a little bit more optimized by specifying that the latest the most recent core that has accessed a particular cache line is the one responsible for answering the read requests now, and this is done by going to a specific state, which is this forward state, and this is supposed to reduce the communication or contention on the bus quite a lot. Yeah, but well, this is probably just a little bit of an optimization, not tackling the whole problem of buses having to connect more and more cores. I don't know. Last time we have already talked about how many cores nowadays are in use, and they're particularly for the server systems. The number of cores is growing, 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 and the more these systems grow, the less this MESI protocol actually scales for high performance things. So usually, what you do is you do groups of CPUs that have a bus locally and have point-to-point links to other groups of CPUs, which leads to these numerous systems, which have kind of very well, in comparison to the ordinary MESI-based systems, have quite complicated architecture diagrams and messages that are going from one processor to the other, with the context of, well, some processes are kind of responsible, or some groups are responsible for taking care of particular address segments, and as soon as one other processor is interested in those, he has to communicate with that particular subgroup in order to request the cache lines from there. And well, this is a kind of a quite complicated approach that I would refer to the actual lectures from the from our hardware chair, like the high performance computing lectures, should give you more insight about the cache coherent protocols in these kind of massive parallel systems. We at that point will stop with cache coherence in terms of consistency systems and continue next time with lock-free, wait-free, and locked algorithms. And with that, I want to thank you for your attention and wish you a nice week. See you next time.